This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Hour after hour after hour. Today's public impeachment hearings on Capitol Hill have stretched all day long. Before we dive into the highlights, let's meet the four witnesses.
You know, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
And Ms. Williams, do you agree that...
Ambassador Volker, you testified.
Mr. Morrison, you were recognized for your opening statement.
First up, two current White House employees. Both were on the July 25th phone call where President Trump asked Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for, quote, a favor.
Mr. Chairman, ranking members, thank you for the opportunity to address the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He serves on the National Security Council and coordinates U.S. policy toward Ukraine. And in blue military dress, Vindman told the committee he felt it was his duty to report President Trump's phone call.
It was improper for the president to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent.
Next to him at the witness table sat Jennifer Williams. She's a career Foreign Service officer who's been working in Vice President Mike Pence's office. Williams also heard Trump's call, and she said she found it unusual and inappropriate.
In contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter.
Then, in the afternoon, the Intelligence Committee swore in two more witnesses. This pair requested by Republicans.
Microphones are sensitive, so please speak directly into them.
Until recently, Tim Morrison was the National Security Council Director for Russia. He didn't think he heard anything illegal on that July 25th phone call, but it still worried him.
I feared at the time of the call on July 25th how its disclosure would play in Washington's political climate. My fears have been realized.
Finally, there's Kurt Volker, former U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine. He was not on the call, but Democrats have suggested Volker was part of an irregular diplomatic back channel led by President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Volker tried to knock down that idea. He told lawmakers he was left out of key discussions about U.S. policy in Ukraine.
I did not know of any linkage between the hold on security assistance and Ukraine pursuing investigations.
All right, we're going to spend the rest of the hour examining what these four witnesses have said today about President Trump and whether Trump pressured Ukraine to investigate his political rivals. We've got a panel of four NPR correspondents in the studio to help us do that. Welcome to all four of you. I'll bring you guys in one by one. But NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, let's start with you. I want to start focusing on the two witnesses from this morning. We had Foreign Service Officer Jennifer Williams and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. Both listened in on that now famous July 25th. Phone call. Why did Democrats want to call those two witnesses in specifically to talk about that call?
Well, I think the overarching strategy of the week and the testimonies of the week are to more directly link President Trump to the actions that took place over the spring, summer, and fall. And as you said, on this specific question, they were on that July 25th phone call, and both in their closed-door deposition and under oath today said that they thought it was either improper or inappropriate, in the words of Alexander Vindman, or at least was unusual and injected politics into a call that doesn't normally involve domestic politics.
Let's listen specifically to the words of Alexander Vindman. Here he is talking about how he felt while he was listening in on that July 25th call.
On July 25th, 2019, the call occurred. I listened on the call in the Situation Room with White House colleagues. I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, what struck you about that particular remark from Vindman?
Well, the thing that was important about it was that this is firsthand testimony. This is what Republicans have been complaining about, that all of the witnesses so far have been heard things secondhand or thirdhand or hearsay. But Alexander Vindman was, as he said, in the Situation Room listening to the call. He, as you said, interpreted it as inappropriate and improper. He did what he's supposed to do, go up the chain of command. He'd been told earlier, because he'd been at a July 10th meeting between national security staff and Ukrainians, where Gordon Sondland, who we'll hear from tomorrow, brought up this exact same trade, start an investigation into the Bidens, and you'll get a meeting with the president and military aid. So he went, he was told at that time to bring his concerns to the White House lawyers. This wasn't the first time he visited them. Went to John Eisenberg, National Security Council, and reported his concerns. And what was important about it was here's somebody in real time listening to the call and deciding that, unlike what the president said, it wasn't perfect.
I will jump in here. This is Mary Louise, and I want to jump in and just draw us to one of the more dramatic moments of testimony from where I sat, which was this visual of Vindman in his full military dress uniform, active duty U.S. Army lieutenant colonel, criticizing the actions of the president and the commander-in-chief, even as the White House official Twitter account started tweeting out an attack of him. Mara, I wonder if you would just tell us what they tweeted, and then I want to bring in Ryan Lucas as well. Mara.
What's really interesting is the other day when Marie Yovanovitch testified, the president tweet attacked her in real time.
Mm-hmm.
This time, it wasn't the president's Twitter account. It was the White House official account, as you said.
Taxpayer-funded.
Taxpayer-funded. And they tweeted a quote from Tim Morrison, who testified this afternoon, quote, I had concerns about his judgment, meaning he had concerns about Vindman's judgment. This was a concerted attempt by the White House and allies to undermine Vindman's credibility. As you said, he's a military officer. He got a Purple Heart. He was wounded in Iraq. He's also a immigrant from the former Soviet Union. He gave a very powerful, emotional opening statement about why his father came to America. And there were a lot of attacks on his credibility, and that was one of them.
Yeah, Ryan Lucas, our justice correspondent, who's also here with us. I mean, what did you make of this? What rippled through the hearing room as, again, we watched this Twitter, you know, Twitter accounts playing out in real time in the hearing room and witnesses responding?
Well, I think that what we saw with Vindman generally and the Republicans was, as Mara said, a consistent attempt to undermine his credibility, to question how he characterized his work at the White House, to suggest that he had overstated his responsibilities, what he actually does at the White House. There were a number of times when they got to questions of perhaps him having dual loyalties, of the fact that he was born in the Soviet Union. Perhaps he is not fully on board with the American project, so to speak. And that's something that was quite apparent in the first hearing that Vindman was actually in, but it also continued into the second hearing when Morrison was testifying, and they got once again into questions of his judgment and assessments of his work on the National Security Council.
I do want to get into how Republicans approach Vindman as at least his character during today's hearing. You know, Vindman gave a very powerful opening statement. He talked about how, you know, he spoke directly to his father who had left the former Soviet Union. He said that he was hoping he was making his father proud and that he agreed that with his father that, you know, he too wanted to support the values of American democracy. But I want to play this unusual exchange between the staff attorney for Republicans and Vindman. And this pertains to an offer from a Ukrainian politician to make Vindman potentially the defense minister of the Ukrainian government.
I'm an American. I came here when I was a toddler, and I immediately dismissed these offers, did not entertain them.
When he made this offer to you initially, did you leave the door open? Was there a reason that he had to come back and ask a second and third time, or was he just trying to convince you?
Yeah, counsel, you know what? It's the whole notion is rather comical that I was being asked to consider whether I'd want to be the Minister of Defense. I did not leave the door open at all.
Okay.
But it is pretty funny for a Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, which really isn't that senior, to be offered that illustrious a position.
I mean, my ears were perking up during this part of the testimony. Ryan or anyone here can jump in. Why do you think Republicans wanted to tease out this offer by the Ukrainian government to Vindman to make him the future defense minister of Ukraine?
Oh, he has dual loyalties. We already saw this. Laura Ingraham, you know, he's from Ukraine. He talks to Ukrainians. He's working for another country. First of all, it's an anti-Semitic trope, dual loyalties. Vindman happens to be Jewish. But it's just to impugn his credibility. I think I wouldn't be surprised if this goes viral in right-wing media. But there was something else along these lines that really struck me. It was Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, senator, wrote a letter to the committee where he talked about people trying to sabotage the president. And then he said, quote, Vindman might be one of those people. And another quote, his it's entirely possible that Vindman fits this profile. That is the textbook definition of innuendo.
What I didn't get is how does crafting Vindman as a pro-Ukrainian, a potentially pro-Ukrainian person, how does that square with also this idea of Vindman buttressing the case for a quid pro quo between President Trump and President Zelensky? Like, in that scenario, a quid pro quo between those two leaders, neither leader comes off looking particularly great. So how is that a pro-Ukrainian sort of position? Anyone?
Well, he told on the president. Who knows? But whatever it is, it was designed to cast, to raise questions about his credibility and his patriotism.
I want to jump in and bring in Michelle Kellerman, our diplomatic correspondent, and just ask one question about Ukraine specifically and this other thing that President Trump was interested in investigating along with the Bidens, which was asking President Zelensky to look into this conspiracy theory that it was Ukraine that interfered in 2016, not Russia. That we've got a little bit of that. This is Joaquin Castro, Democrat of Texas, questioning Vindman about that idea that Ukraine interfered.
Colonel Vindman, are you aware of any evidence to support the theory that the Ukrainian government interfered in the 2016 election?
Congressman, I am not, and I'm furthermore, I would say that this is a Russian narrative that President Putin has promoted.
And are you aware of any part of the U.S. government, its foreign policy or intelligence apparatus that supports that theory?
No, I'm not aware of.
And you are aware that other parts of the U.S. government, our intelligence community, for example, has said definitively that it was the Russians who interfered in the 2016 elections.
That is correct.
Michelle, did we get anywhere further on putting this to rest? Is this going to continue to come up in these hearings as they continue to play?
Oh, I think it will continue to come up in the hearings because you hear clearly that the president mentioned CrowdStrike in his phone call. He talks about all of this is about opening up investigations into 2016, meaning what the Ukrainians were doing in meddling in our elections. You know, people like Colonel Vindman understand what the intelligence was and continue to lay out the facts in that case. I think you'll hear a lot more about that from Fiona Hill, who used to be his boss, because she's testifying
later this week.
Later this week. And she talked a lot in her closed-door deposition about how Republicans are going down a rabbit hole here.
All right. We're going to have more about today's public testimony in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. This is special coverage from NPR News.
Back with a panel of NPR correspondents to make sense of day three of public testimony in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. We've already talked a little bit about Jennifer Williams and Alexander Vindman, two witnesses who listened in on the now famous July 25th phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. That is the phone call that establishes, quote, where Trump said he wanted, quote, a favor. So I want to talk about how Democrats and Republicans approach these two witnesses more generally. So I guess, Sue, let's start with you. Can you explain what you picked up as the Republican strategy today, at least in the way they approach both Vindman and Jennifer Williams?
Well, I think that their focus certainly centered much more on Vindman. Williams was not as much a core player today in the testimony. And beyond the point that she testified that we already knew that she thought it was unusual to talk about politics in the call, they did not come back to her time and time again the way they did in Vindman. I think to the point about the questioning his loyalty, that whole line of questioning, going down, pursuing lines of whether he knew the whistleblower or potentially communicated with the whistleblower, which he testified that he did not know who the whistleblower was. But those were all part of these calculated efforts, as Mara has talked to sort of undermine the witness in the public's eyes, to make it seem like he is someone that had political motivations of his own, and that I believe in the terms of one of the congressmen, Chris Stewart, who's a Republican from Utah, is that there were a lot of people on this call, and people have different interpretations of what was said. Vindman believes that something inappropriate happened, and Republicans simply believe he's wrong, which is why Republicans were also eager to hear from other witnesses later in the day who drew different conclusions from the call.
I want to stay with this idea of lines of questioning from Republicans, because a key one that we heard throughout today was, what exactly is the president being accused of? You know, if you Democrats want to impeach him, what do you want to impeach him for? Here's one exchange that's a sample of that. This is an exchange between Vindman and Republican John Ratcliffe of Texas.
I've word searched each of your transcripts. And the word bribery or bribe doesn't appear anywhere in that. Ms. Williams, you've never used the word bribery or bribe to explain President Trump's conduct, correct?
No, sir.
Colonel Vindman, you haven't either.
That is correct.
The problem is, in an impeachment inquiry that the Speaker of the House says is all about bribery, where bribery is the impeachable offense, no witness has used the word bribery to describe President Trump's conduct. None of them.
Ryan Lucas, Mara Liasson, let me let you both jump in on this one. Republicans say Democrats keep changing the goalpost. Do we have any better sense after today, if they're going to draft articles of impeachment, what might be in there? Ryan.
I don't think that we know at this point in time what exactly will be in there. I think that the best hint that we have gotten yet did come from Speaker Pelosi when she suggested that bribery is something that appears to have taken place. What Republicans have consistently tried to do is bring this back to a question of whether the president did anything illegal, was a crime committed. And what Democrats frequently point to is that impeachment is not a legal process per se. This is not a court of law. This is a political process. And the bar is whether the behavior reaches the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors, bribery, treason. Those are things mentioned.
And therefore, just to put a pin in that, Tim Morrison, another witness today, saying that he didn't think anything happened on the call that was illegal. How relevant is that to the impeachment inquiry?
Well, the argument from Democrats is that it is irrelevant to the impeachment inquiry, and also that it's not his decision to make. It is to the lawmakers to conduct this inquiry, gather as much information as they can, learn the facts, and then come to the conclusion whether the president's behavior, whether there was abuse of power, and whether his behavior rises to this threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mara, jump on
here's,
that.
Here's the problem. A lawyer said that recently that even though you don't need a crime to impeach someone, it sure helps to have one. Mm-hmm. Because the reason right. why Nancy Pelosi is focusing on the word bribery, that bribery appears in the Constitution. The
not
actual quid pro quo.
Not quid pro quo.
It's something
it
people
yeah.
understand.
Yeah.
And here's the problem. In our recent NPR poll and a lot of other polls I've seen, huge numbers of people, in our poll it's 70%, say asking a foreign leader to investigate a political rival is wrong. It's not acceptable. What Democrats have to do is make the leap from it being wrong to it being such an abuse of power that it's worth impeaching and removing the president over it. And that's the problem. Republicans have pretty much settled. They're not trying to actually dispute the facts. We've seen the rough transcript. The president definitely asked Zelensky to investigate the Bidens. That's not in dispute. The Republicans have settled, yes, he did this, but it's not impeachable.
I want to talk about another line of questioning that happened today. We briefly mentioned it. This is in response, or this is regards to the whistleblower. Let's listen to Ranking Member Devin Nunes of California questioning Vindman. And in this exchange, Vindman is trying to discuss the July 25th phone call, saying that he discussed it with someone in the intelligence community.
What agency was this individual from? If I could interject here. We don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower, that is not the purpose that we are here for. And I want to advise the witness accordingly.
Okay, Sue Davis, what's going on there? What is the strategy of potentially bringing up the whistleblower or potentially outing the whistleblower? Can you just explain how that was unfolding today?
Sure. One thing I would also note is that last week, the House Ethics Committee issued a memorandum to all lawmakers and officers of the House, warning them that it was against the rules of the House to disclose classified information in a public setting. So it was sort of a warning shot to everyone on Capitol Hill ahead of these hearings. Don't play games with the rules of the House. Republicans have been doing this, I think, because the target of the whistleblower has been certainly a popular and frequent critic of the president. So I think part of that is doing the White House bidding to say that if they don't know who the White House blower, the whistleblower is, that the president has a right to confront his accuser. That is part of the White House argument.
The whistleblower is not there to be confronted.
And we don't know who the whistleblower is. Republicans have also said that, Democrats did say initially they wanted to hear from the whistleblower. However, Democrats have made the point that the whistleblower did not have firsthand knowledge. The whistleblower built the complaint around secondhand information, all of which has been corroborated in any number of pieces of public testimony. So there is no conflict with what was in the whistleblower complaint and what is known. I think focusing on the whistleblower on the Republican side is it's a much more of a political tactic. I've said it's a bit of a red herring to kind of focus the public on this potentially nefariousness of the whistleblower's motives when there's nothing that was in the complaint that has been contradicted by the facts.
All right, I'm going to do a pivot and move us on because there were not one but two panels this afternoon. In the early afternoon, Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, gaveled everybody back into order, and here he is opening up the second session.
It's no less. Welcome back to Act Two of today's circus, ladies and gentlemen. We are here to continue what the Democrats tell us is a serious, somber, and even prayerful process of attempting to overthrow a duly elected president. If they're successful, the end result would be to disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans who thought the president is chosen by the American people.
All right, that was not Adam Schiff. You may have gathered that was Republican Devin Nunes. They both got to make opening statements, which speaks a little bit to just the process and how this was unfolding. It was similar from morning to afternoon, where each side got to ask questions for 45 minutes, and then they went to questions from each of the members. One of the key questions, Michelle Kellerman, that was they were trying to get at this afternoon was there an irregular diplomatic policy being played out by the so-called three amigos, one of whom was testifying this afternoon. What exactly were lawmakers trying to determine, and what did we learn?
Well, it's Kurt Volker, and he does not like the term three amigos. He made clear of that. And he was actually, you know, sort of in the regular channel, he says, but he seems to be trying to bridge the two. And I'll explain. I mean, he's the U.S. envoy to Ukraine. His mission was to help Ukraine end the war with Russia.
By the way, what's the difference between an ambassador to Ukraine and a special envoy to Ukraine?
So he's not the ambassador. He's not the man on the ground. He's goes back and forth, and he's an envoy because he has to deal with other countries that were involved in the negotiations. So with Germany and France, et cetera. And he was, by the way, part-time and non-paid. So,
Didn't know that. Okay.
And nobody's going to take over that role now that he's left. But, you know, so he was giving the overarching view that this administration has done a lot to support Ukraine, but that the president had a very negative opinion about Ukraine. And he came to learn that it's because Rudy Giuliani has his ear. So what Volker tried to do, he says, is try to change Giuliani's view of Ukraine in order to get the president to change his view. And so he, because he was this kind of part-time sort of envoy, he had a little more freedom than regular career diplomats to work these other channels. And he put the Ukrainians in touch with Giuliani to talk about how they can change President Trump's mind.
By the way, although he was portrayed as one of the three, he has been portrayed as one of the three amigos, along with EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland and Energy Secretary Rick Perry, sort of like this inside irregular channel that was trying to do policy towards Ukraine. What was striking about Volker's testimony today is a lot of his thesis was, I didn't know this and this and this was really going on. I want to play for you an exchange where Volker is trying to say, look, I knew that President Trump wanted to investigate Burisma, but I didn't know that's the Ukrainian gas company, but I didn't know that really meant that was code for investigating the Bidens. Here you go.
I understood that there was an important distinction between Burisma and Biden. I urged the Ukrainians to maintain such a distinction. I did not know that President Trump or others had raised Vice President Biden with Ukrainians, or had conflated the investigation of possible Ukrainian corruption with investigation of the former vice president. In retrospect, for the Ukrainians, it would clearly have been confusing.
Michelle, is that an evolution of how he's been explaining his role and what he knew and what he didn't know?
Well, yes. I mean, he said he was trying to thread this needle that, you know, he knows that Giuliani keeps talking about Burisma and 2016 and wanted the Ukrainians to make a statement about that. And he actually you know, encouraged the Ukrainians to make a statement. It wasn't specific enough for Giuliani, and eventually the Ukrainians dropped it. But, you know, he talks about this idea of threading the needle, like, okay, the Ukrainians can announce that they're doing these investigations, but, you know, as long as it doesn't seem like they're doing something for political purposes for the U.S., then that's fine. But it became clear when you read the call transcript that the president wasn't talking about, you know, anti-corruption in general. He was talking about 2016 and Burisma. I mean, and the Bidens. And he mentioned right. The Bidens specifically.
And the word Burisma does not appear in the transcript. No. Only Bidens.
And one thing that I'll add on the Volker Burisma point is that Tim Morrison, who testified alongside Volker today,
former National Security Council analyst.
Yeah. Right. He said that the minute that he heard the word Burisma, he went and Googled it and understood immediately that that related to the Bidens. And that
maybe Volker didn't have Google
to stay away from. and the thing about Volker is that Volker's portfolio was specifically Ukraine. And he was aware of Giuliani pushing these conspiracy theories and lies about Ambassador Yovanovitch. And this idea that he would not connect Burisma to Biden is something that he has consistently said, but I think Democratic lawmakers certainly had questions about that.
And it really, I mean, first of all, he paints himself as extremely naive. That's his defense. Not only did he not know that Burisma was a code word for Biden's, he also insists that the reason the president had these negative views of Ukraine was because Rudy Giuliani was whispering in his ear. It goes back so much farther. First of all, everything about CrowdStrike, Ukrainian intervention.
CrowdStrike, the cybersecurity
right,
firm.
Is a Russian talking point. As a Russian talking point, as Alexander Vindman testified, the president ran, you could say, in 2016 as the anti-Ukraine, pro-Russian candidate. He was for Crimea, staying with the Russians. He hired Paul Manafort, the former political advisor to the pro-Russian strongman leader of Ukraine who was deposed in the revolution. Mm-hmm. He had his campaign intervene at the Republican convention to remove language from the Republican platform in favor of providing military aid to Ukraine. In other words, this goes back a very long way. It's not just because Rudy Giuliani started telling him some things.
I want to do a lightning round here and get each of the four of you to weigh in on this. And here's the question. Did this afternoon's testimony, this afternoon's witnesses, help the Republicans' case? Because these were, we should say, these are the first two witnesses we have heard from that Republicans wanted to call, that they felt the nation needed to hear from. Sue Davis, was that an effective move for Republicans?
I think it certainly gave Republicans their best sound bites that they've had in these testimonies and ones that will give them ability to play it over and over. But the fundamental fact is they haven't disputed any of the core facts of the case. And on the
saying our fundamental understanding of the narrative
did not change. They haven't put forward a different narrative of what the president's motivations were or why he made these decisions. And on the simple politics of it, Democrats control the House. And in a question of impeachment, Republican votes aren't necessarily the one that matters.
Ryan.
I, too, think that they had a good day in terms of sound bites, certainly better than they had last week at any point in time. I also think that they have an easier hill to climb in a sense that Democrats have to try to convince the broader American public that impeaching the president is something that needs to happen. Republicans just need to sow enough doubt among half the population that this is not something that deserves for the president to be impeached over. And I think that they got certainly some ammunition for that today.
Mm-hmm. Mara?
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought they got some talking points. For Democrats, no, they haven't been able to create a groundswell for impeachment. The country is impeachment and removal. Let me be very specific. The country is still really split on that. Our own poll shows 44% in favor and opposed to impeachment and removal.
And our own poll shows most Americans say, my mind's made up. There's nothing I could learn
from
these
hearings. We're going to be stuck. Like, surprise, surprise, we're divided down the middle, as we are in every single other way. But I think that for Democrats who came into this whole proceedings worried that there'd be a backlash against impeachment, that hasn't happened either. In other words, if they can maintain this and make the argument that the president abused his power, I think Democrats come out okay. So, you know, we're split down the middle. He's not going to be removed in the Senate. 20 Republicans are not going to flip. The House is doing its duty to hold the president accountable, make sure no one's above the law. And as far as the political endgame of this, no one can predict that with any confidence.
Democrats may not be doing themselves damage, but are they picking up? Are they changing minds out there in the public?
I don't think they're changing too many minds. You saw support for impeachment and removal go up a little bit, but it's kind of plateaued, and that's where we are.
Michelle Kellerman, were these effective witnesses? Was this a good day for Republicans?
Well, I mean, they certainly got to argue that someone like Kurt Volker, it was the first person they've heard from who spoke to both President Trump and to the Ukrainians. And he testified that at least he didn't tell Ukrainians that any of this aid was being held up in you know, for as a quid pro quo for investigations. But then the next person that they're going to hear from is Gordon Sondland tomorrow. And that's going to be a very different story because he was telling Ukrainians very different things.
One recurring argument that we've been hearing from Republicans is that so far Democrats have been presenting a lot of hearsay evidence, a lot of secondhand, third-hand evidence. Today, three of the four witnesses were directly on that July 25th phone call. But let me ask, any of you can jump in on this. What is the direct evidence that that Democrats are still missing that would inform everyone about the events that led to the July 25th phone call and beyond that?
Well, one of the things that we're certainly listening for in tomorrow's hearings is one of the revelations that's come out is about conversations Gordon Sondland had directly with President Trump, overheard by at least three aides the day after the Zelensky call, in which the president personally asked about the status of the investigations.
All right. You're listening to special coverage of the impeachment inquiry from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. On Capitol Hill today, four witnesses testifying for, well, about 11 hours and change, telling a House panel and the American public what they know about President Trump and the, quote, favor he asked of Ukraine's president.
Before we continue with our panel of NPR correspondents, let's hear from someone who has been in this marathon session. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy is a Democrat from Illinois and a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Thank you very much for joining us after a long, long day.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
So of all the hours and hours of testimony you heard today, what stood out the most to you?
Well, I think Lieutenant Colonel Vindman this morning stood out in terms of just as a matter of fact testimony. He didn't overstate anything. He was a compelling witness. And I think that he handled some of the attacks from folks on the other side with poise, and I personally think that he was very convincing.
Okay, so he may have been able to repel, according to you, some of the attacks on his character or his impartiality, but given the three other witnesses, and also him that you listened to today, was your knowledge in any way advanced, your understanding of whether President Trump pressured President Zelensky of Ukraine to do something that would help Trump's reelection efforts? Did you learn anything new is what I'm asking.
I did. I'll just give you one example. Ambassador Volker was present in Ukraine for, some part of the last 4 months at issue here. But unfortunately, he wasn't really part of any of the main conversations or meetings where, these allegations of quid pro quo, military assistance for investigations, really occurred.
According to him, he was the amigo of the three amigos who really wasn't on the inside.
Right. I think what I took away from his testimony is that there might be two amigos instead of three amigos. And, those two amigos, according to him, basically handled most of the, the irregular part of the diplomacy or the shadow diplomacy that was happening in Ukraine. And so because of that, unfortunately, he wasn't able to shed a lot of light on some of these conversations. On the other hand, a couple things that he did say that were enlightening is he said, there's no way that Joe Biden or Hunter Biden should be investigated, and that this former prosecutor general named Lutsenko is basically a fraud. He's not credible. He should be the source of attacks on anybody. Unfortunately, he informs some of even President Trump's thinking on the subject in Ukraine, though.
Well, where do you come down on the question of whether President Trump should be removed from office? Are you for impeaching him?
I withhold judgment until all the facts are in evidence. This is a three-step process, theoretically. Step one is the inquiry, which is what we're in right now. Step two is the impeachment stage, where the House would formally file charges against the president. And then step three, if it goes to that, is a trial in the Senate and a potential removal. But, you know, we're a long ways from that.
That's fair.
Right now, I think we just got to gather the facts.
That's fair. There have been a lot of potential impeachable offenses being thrown around about what Democrats are thinking to impeach him for, whether it be bribery, quid pro quo, obstruction of justice, witness intimidation. What is the list in your head of possible impeachable offenses?
Unfortunately, there's a lot that are at issue here with the same facts. So, for instance, some people see abuse of power, going up to coercion, to potentially bribery. And then there's also obstruction of justice, which is something that obviously we learned from the Mueller report as well, and there might be obstruction in the current fact pattern with Ukraine.
All right. That's Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Illinois. Thank you very much for joining us after your very long night.
Hey, thank you, folks.
We also wanted to hear from an ally of the president. Earlier today, I spoke with Mark Lotter. He is director of strategic communications for the Trump 2020 campaign. I asked him about a line of questioning today from some Republicans, questions seeking to cast doubt on Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's judgment and his loyalty. I asked Mark Lotter if he questioned Vindman's loyalty.
You need to honor the service of any person who has worn the uniform of the United States, served, and been decorated for that service. But having said that, I also don't think that that shields you from scrutiny when it comes to matters of your opinion. So I think it's entirely appropriate to be able to question that while still honoring his service to our country.
Were you listening as the questions unfolded from the GOP counsel, the attorney asking questions on behalf of Republicans, asking Vindman about this offer to go be Ukraine's defense minister? What should we take away from that?
I think it's interesting that he was offered that position apparently on multiple occasions.
But, and turned it down on multiple occasions.
And turned it
and
down.
And says he found it comical.
But I think ultimately what this comes down to is that we have confirmed this morning from two people who were on the call that the call is correct, substantially correct, I think is the term that they were using.
The July 25th call.
We can still see that there was still no quid pro quo. And when it came to the concerns that were raised by the lieutenant colonel, well, those that were his opinions and his interpretation of things rather than actually what the call itself entailed.
You are correct that he confirmed that the readout of the call provided by the White House was substantially correct. He also said he was so alarmed by it that he reported it straight up the chain of command to his superiors, which prompts this next question, because we heard Republicans questioning today Vindman's credibility. We heard them attacking the media, attacking the process, but never attacking the substance of the question at the heart of these proceedings, which is whether it is appropriate for the president to ask a foreign government to investigate a U.S. citizen who is his political opponent. In your view, is it? Is that appropriate?
I think you're leaving out one key element. We are not discussing a random political opponent. We are discussing the then sitting vice president of the United States of America, who both the witnesses this morning said they were concerned by the appearance of conflict of interest, the corruption that was involved with the company that Joe Biden's son worked for. So it is absolutely appropriate, and I would say required, for a president to see if the then vice president of the United States, if there was anything amiss or afoul or unethical that was happening between his son's service while he was also in office.
You're talking about former Vice President Biden, who, I mean, this is not happening in a vacuum, who is running for president of the United States against President Trump in 2020. Is it appropriate for the president to ask a foreign government to investigate a U.S. citizen who was and remains his political opponent?
If running for office will somehow become a shield where no one running for office can ever be investigated for ethical questions or possible inappropriate activities because they're running for office, then no one will ever stop running for office. I don't believe a political campaign can be a shield for something that happened in the execution of one's official's duties.
And yet I do not hear a defense from Republicans in that committee or for you of the president's actions as he himself described them on the readout from that July 25th call.
Well, what I can tell you is that there was no quid pro quo. Ukraine said that they did not feel any pressure. The aid was released. And once again, we have found that now the Democrats have gone from collusion to obstruction to quid pro quo. Now they poll tested bribery. That's falling apart. And now who knows what they're going to accuse him of next week.
That is Mark Lauder, Director of Strategic Communications for the Trump 2020 campaign. Before that, we heard from Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. And I want to bring in one more voice, the voice of the president. This is President Trump responding to a question about the investigation.
Because right now you have a kangaroo court headed by little Shifty Schiff, where we don't have lawyers, we don't have witnesses, we don't have anything. And yet I just got to watch. And the Republicans are absolutely killing it. They are doing so well because it's a scam. It's a big scam.
The president speaking today, Mara Liasson. What did we learn today about where White House strategy and tactics to respond to these impeachment hearings may be headed?
Well, we already talked about the White House trying to impugn the credibility of Vindman. Trump said he would let people, quote, make their own determination about Vindman, but he went on to say, I don't know him at all. And certainly Vindman testified he's never talked to the president directly. But already Dan Scavino, who is the kind of the aide in the White House who directs the president's Twitter account to the extent that the president relinquishes it himself, is already tweeting the part of the hearing where Vindman is asked about this offer from the Ukrainians to become the defense minister, but the clip that Scavino plays leaves out the part where Vindman says he rejected the offer.
So that's a switch from last week when President Trump was professing that he was too busy to be watching. But
no, they're quite engaged and they're fighting back. And they're trying to impugn the credibility of the
witness. Sue Davis.
Peter Welch, he's a Democrat from Vermont who's on the committee, made what I thought was a very interesting point today, certainly hearing a Democrat say it, where he said, you know, President Trump could have investigated Burisma and Biden's in the 2016 election. He had the tools. He's sitting on $125 million in his campaign account. He could have used his campaign apparatus to do any number of political investigations. Those investigations unto themselves aren't the problem. It's the fact that he did it in the role of president that is the question of impeachment, which I think sometimes gets confused in that it was politically motivated. There are vehicles and channels to do politically motivated investigations of your political opponent. It's just not through the official channels.
Or if he wants to elevate an investigation of the Bidens into U.S. foreign policy, I suppose he could have asked Bill Barr to investigate Joe Biden.
All right. So in the last few minutes we have left, I want to go around the room here and have each of you kind of give us a final parting thought, reflecting back on everything you've heard so far in the impeachment inquiry and what you're looking ahead to in the days ahead. I'm just going to start with Michelle Kellerman over there.
Well, when we talked about the attacks on Vindman, I thought one of the interesting things was, you know, well, he didn't have that one-on-one FaceTime with President Trump and that, you know, he was overstating what he was doing, when in fact, you know, I think that reflects pretty poorly on the president to not go to experts in his White House, career people who have knowledge, who understand the region. He speaks Russian and Ukrainian and understands, you know, what Russia's up to in Ukraine and why it's important to push back.
Ryan Lucas?
I'm going to put on my DOJ hat for a second here.
And do it.
What has struck me with today and then looking ahead to tomorrow and looking at these witnesses over the course of a week or so, is this looks a lot like how prosecutors would present witnesses in a case. And that
interesting. Adam Schiff is a former prosecutor,
but they had two very strong witnesses, actually three last week for the Democratic position with Ambassador Bill Taylor, George Kent, former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. They had two other witnesses today that were good for them, Vindman and Williams. Then they had Morrison and Volker. But tomorrow is really the key witness in all of this, I think. He's emerged as really the person who has the most direct contact with the president on the key questions here of pushing Ukraine for investigations, and that is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. He's already had to revise his testimony once. When prosecutors are bringing witnesses, they often put somebody who might be the least trustworthy witness right in the middle, and then you go back and you get strong witnesses to finish off the case with, and that would be Fiona Hill. So that's what I see looking ahead to tomorrow, that being a very, very key day. And there are a lot of questions for Gordon Sondland regarding what has emerged is a July 26th phone call that he had with the president himself about investigations in the Biden.
Right. That was a cell phone conversation that was overheard in a restaurant in Ukraine.
Right.
Okay. Sue Davis.
So politically, the thing that I've been thinking about at these hearings today and we go forward is from our own NPR poll, in which we've talked a lot about how most people's minds are made up and the country's divided. But the number in the poll today was 30%. That's the number of Americans who have not made up their mind yet. And I know that the majority has, but 30% is still
a sizable chunk.
3 in 10 Americans still say that new information could make them change their mind. 4 in 10 independents say the same thing. There is still a lot of malleability in this country to make up their minds about what the president did and whether his conduct was impeachable. So I think as we still have a lot of impeachment process let to go, I think it's still good to be hesitant about drawing too grand of political conclusions just yet.
But just to jump off a little bit from that, how much do you think this would change the landscape of 2020, like the impeachability question?
That's a good question. I mean, Mars made this point over and over again, is do voters, even if they think Trump's conduct was inappropriate, do they still see it as their job to make that decision on whether or not he should have or lose the job?
Not the Senate's job.
Not the Senate's job.
And voters are feel pretty strongly about their right at the ballot box to decide if someone stays in office, and I think that they should be. I think my takeaway is Gordon Sondland is a real wild card. We don't know if he's going to be a good witness for the Democrats, a good witness for the Republicans, or just all around unreliable because he's changed his testimony. He's been described as someone who wanted to paint himself as being kind of a real player. He talked to the president a lot. He certainly was careless about security on his phone. And the president, we also don't know who's going to throw who under the bus tomorrow. Because don't forget, in October, the president called Gordon Sondland a great American. In November, he said, I hardly know the gentleman. So, you know, tomorrow is a wild card. We don't know exactly what Sondland is going to do.
Can we just talk a little bit about timeline going forward in this impeachment inquiry? How many more days are we expecting of the House Intelligence Committee questioning witnesses? And then doesn't it goes to the House Judiciary Committee? Can someone just kind of like explain what are the next steps that we should be expecting going forward?
There's no public hearings yet beyond this week. Mm-hmm. What if you believe Democrats who, and so far they haven't changed the timeline, they'd really like to wrap up in the House by the end of the year. They're supposed to be gone next week for Thanksgiving. Thank God for that, I would say. And when they come back, they've got about 3.5 weeks. And so the process they've outlined is that once Intel will send a report to the Judiciary Committee on its recommendations. The Judiciary Committee still has to have hearings on articles of impeachment. It would still have to report out articles of impeachment, and the whole House would still have to vote on articles of impeachment, all within a roughly 3 to 4 week period of time. So Democrats are cooking
here. It's going to be tight to get it done by the end of the year.
If that's the goal of the timeline, and I believe it still is as we sit here tonight, it is going to be a very busy rush after the Thanksgiving holiday.
And think about how quickly this has happened. Even just last week, we were hearing this new testimony from a State Department official who overheard Gordon Sondland on the phone with President Trump a day after the famous call in July. And, you know, after that came out in testimony last week, the fellow David Holmes came to Washington, had a closed-door deposition last Friday evening, and then he's going to be testifying in public on Thursday.
On Thursday with Fiona Hill.
Right.
All right. So let's go over how many. We've got Gordon Sondland, EU ambassador. We've got Fiona Hill. We've got David Holmes. Anyone left this week?
Yeah, we've got two David more Hale. Tomorrow. I will throw in David Hale, mm-hmm. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Laura Cooper, Deputy Defense Secretary, and of course the headliner, as we've all mentioned, Gordon Sondland. So another quiet day tomorrow. One more quick thing to throw at you all, Sue, when you were talking about the timeline going forward. That is the timeline as Democrats would like it to unfold. Do Republicans have more witnesses they want to call, are likely to be able to call, including, I guess, the biggest one of all, President Trump, who tweeted he might be open to this?
Hey, written testimony, though. Didn't he say written testimony?
Yeah. Speaker Pelosi has said the president is welcome to testify or to supply written answers to any questions. He's kind of suggested on Twitter he might consider it. I don't know anyone on Capitol Hill who believes the president's really going to engage in this process. It would sort of undermine the whole White House argument that this is a sham process to begin with.
Right.
They have, you know, not allowed any of their people to come up and testify, although Congress would very much like to hear from many of them. So, you know, Republicans that I talk to, you know, they're attacking the process, but they don't want this to run long either. And when we talk about going over into the Senate, I do not believe that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sees a long, protracted impeachment trial an advantage to the President of the United States. I think Republicans see tying a bow around this and dispatching with it will give the President a much longer runway to run for re-election as a candidate who was, as he will no doubt explain it, vindicated against charges of, you know, pay-to-play or corruption or whatever they end up possible articles of impeachment on.
And you brought up a very interesting point at another one of these specials, or maybe it was during All Things Considered, that this is actually going to potentially mess up the caucuses, the Iowa caucuses, for like six Democratic candidates at this point. We've got six Democratic senators.
Democratic senators who will be jurors in the trial and, per the rules of the Senate, will be stuck in those seats and not on the campaign trail in Iowa.